Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is astronomer J. M. Pasikoff, Field Memorial Professor of Astronomy and Director of the Hopkins Observatory at Williams College. He is also one of the co-authors of the brand new Peterson Field Guide to Weather. Jay, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Very glad to talk to you.
Now, there are three authors. The other two authors are Jay Anderson and John A. Day and you. How do you all get together to do a field guide to weather? First of all, a field guide to weather. I grew up using Peterson field guides to birds and reptiles and amphibians and mammals. Weather seems like such a huge topic that it seems weird to put a field guide to it.
Well, once upon a time, my mentor, starting with my freshman year at Harvard a long time ago, Donald Menzel, did a Peterson field guide to the stars and planets.
I remember that guide. I remember that guide.
Well, still going on. I'm now the author of the fourth edition, the 16th printing. And then when Dr. Menzel died, I had worked with him on eclipses and other things. I took over the field guide. We did another edition, Menzel and Pasikoff, another edition, Pasikoff and Menzel. Now it's just under my name. So I've been updating that all these years. And then I noticed 15 years ago that the Peterson field guide to the atmosphere hadn't been updated in a while, was out of date. Oh, I could mention, incidentally, that when I first took over the field guide to the stars and planets, I had lunch. My wife and I had lunch with Roger Torrey Peterson. So that was
spectacular. That's a historical moment right there.
That's right. We went down to Connecticut Shore to meet him. So that was fun. So anyway, I noticed that the Peterson field guide to weather hadn't been updated in a while and was looking kind of out of date and all black and white, and needed some updating. It had been done by Vince Schaefer, a very distinguished meteorologist at GE in Schenectady, not far from where I am at Williams College, and John Day, who was known as Cloudman, who was he had a great interest in Luke Howard and clouds, and he survived. My wife and I made a pilgrimage, actually, to go and meet him in McMinnville, Oregon, where I discovered, incidentally, that they have a yearly UFO parade, which doesn't please me.
Jay, you're not into UFOs. Why am I not surprised?
Well, in fact, I mentioned Donald Menzel already. I just pulled off the shelf, given what's going on now, a book of his called Flying Saucers from decades ago. And he was known at one point as, quote, the archfiend of saucerdom. So I'm following in that tradition. But anyway, we had a very nice visit with John Day in McMinnville, Oregon, and he started working on the book, and he worked for a while, but he was already in his 90s, and then he died. And I know about a lot of things in the universe, and how stars shine, and what the temperature of the sun's different layers are, and why there are tornadoes and dust devils on Mars, but not so much terrestrial weather. But one of my specialties has been, since the beginning of, again, my freshman year at Harvard, when I was in a freshman seminar with Donald Menzel, there was a total eclipse of the sun that started over Massachusetts, started over Marblehead, actually. Maybe not even far. I didn't look to see where you are in Worcester.
Yeah.
Near there. And Professor Menzel borrowed a plane, took his friend Din Land and his freshman seminar of 12 people, although minus, I later learned, the one girl who overslept. And we saw this magnificent total solar eclipse out of the window of the plane. And that really got my interest going in solar eclipses. I've now seen 73 solar eclipses.
Are you one of those people that travels around the world to find the peak spot to view the solar eclipse?
Well, shall I say that on June 10th, we went over Canada to see one that went over the North Pole, and December 4th, we're planning to go near Antarctica for the total eclipse there. Does that answer that question?
Yeah, that answers that question. Let me ask you, just backing up to that, is it better to see this an eclipse from a plane or on the ground? I understand that if you're up higher, you have less disturbance from low-lying clouds and stuff like that, but you're moving all the time. So is it better to be in a fixed spot or in a plane?
Well, that answer depends a bit on your point of view, who you are. If you're just an ordinary non-astronomer, you're better off on the ground if the weather is going to be clear.
Right.
Because seeing an eclipse is a whole phenomenon with the sky and the atmosphere all going dark around you. And so it's wonderful to be outside during an eclipse for that whole couple of hours of eclipse phenomena. But if it's going to be cloudy, then you want to see the actual exciting couple of minutes where totality starts, the diamond ring effect.
Oh, wow.
It's dark for a minute or two or three or six, and there's another diamond ring. And so for this coming eclipse in December, I am, in fact, invited to land on Antarctica. But my actual plan is to be in an Airbus 321 at 40,000 feet to see the eclipse out the side of the plane when it's pretty well guaranteed that we can see the eclipse.
Is this your first trip to Antarctica?
Well, we're not going quite to Antarctica. It's out of Punta Arenas.
Oh, I know where. I've actually been to Punta Arenas. Okay.
So we would get the eclipse right at toward the beginning, and then the path goes over a bunch of cruise ships, although the weather forecasts aren't so good there, and then over Antarctica. But if being in a plane counts, in 2003, there was a total solar eclipse over Antarctica, and we took off from Melbourne and flew south and saw the eclipse from over Antarctica, and then we did a little Antarctic sightseeing from the plane. So I've been that far south, but in a plane.
Let me talk to you about the Peterson Field Guide to Weather. You're an astronomer. How did you get involved in this project?
Well, it has to do, again, with the eclipses, in that there's a big eclipse community, and we are in touch with each other on a regular basis. We have a solar eclipse mailing list.
Wow.
And one of the active people is Jay Anderson, who is a retired Canadian meteorologist from near Toronto, and he's been very active in compiling weather statistics from 20 or 25 years of satellite maps of the ground to see what the cloudiness statistics are for seeing eclipses, and also writing up the chances from the kind of normal weather things people have with the statistics of fronts coming through, et cetera. So when John Day died, which of course was too bad, and he had written some materials, I asked Jay Anderson whether he would come into the book with me.
One of the cool things, and this is, I think, the first time this has appeared in a weather guide, is there's a section on the weather on the other planets of the solar system.
Well, that's my specialty in particular. And let me just also mention that the original guide was a field guide to the atmosphere, so this is only a part of that.
Okay.
To weather, but for an astronomer who studies the sun, it seems a little strange to me that I spent so much time studying the other planets. But the techniques that I used in studying eclipses, where we were using electronics to measure rapid variations of the sun's corona, the sun's outer atmosphere, we started using to study the atmospheres of distant planets in our solar system. And this actually comes from when I was at Harvard Graduate School with Jim Elliott, a professor of astronomy at MIT. Unfortunately, he is deceased, and I work with Mike Person, and other people there. But the technique that Jim pioneered was to watch objects in the solar system pass in front of stars. And he started this with Neptune, where I came in when he was working on Neptune, and they make very detailed predictions as to where these things are going to be in the sky and when they're going to pass in front of stars. And when they, he was in an airplane, a NASA airplane, in the South Pacific, and I'm watching for the atmosphere of Neptune to see how the gas in Neptune's atmosphere would bend the starlight, and then there were these blips before, and then blips afterward. I mean, he turned things on a half hour in advance to be sure not to miss it, and they issued a release through the International Astronomical Union that they discovered a swarm of moons around Neptune. But then they realized that the blips were symmetric between the beginning and the end, and that it wasn't moon. It wasn't a lot of moons, but it was rather rings. So they discovered the rings of Neptune, and that's where I came in because I had this solar eclipse equipment for rapid recording of differences, and I was deployed in various places to where, and he was in other places, and we had some other colleagues too. So, for example, I was in Australia with equipment and looking at Neptune's atmosphere, and he was in Hawaii.
Well, you also worked on looking at Triton's, the moon of Neptune's atmosphere, too, right?
Yeah.
Using that same technique, you got to explain a little bit further to for the general audience. How using how a star's how the either Neptune or Triton passing in front of the star is going to give you clues about the atmosphere.
Well, back in 1998, there was a prediction that Triton would go in front of a star, and you could see, I think, that if Triton had no atmosphere, when the star went behind the planet, it would just blink out, and if your equipment is sensitive enough to see the difference, or the star is bright enough compared to the planet to see the difference, you just see the light would drop off automatically, abruptly, and then a few minutes later would come back on. And if there is an atmosphere there, though, the light would diminish gradually, and you'd see a curve in what we call the light curve. In the drop-off, and then it could level off at the bottom a little bit, but then come back again in a curved way. So I participated with some colleagues and one of our Williams College students in an expedition headed by Jim Elliott that we published a paper called Global Warming on Triton.
I saw
in 1998. and we were having fun with the global warming a bit, but over a period of time, we could see that the atmosphere of Triton was warming a bit. So we've applied these techniques not only to...
Wait a minute. Stop there, Jay. You said that the atmosphere is warming a bit on Triton. Is that a periodic warming and then it cools, or is it something that's happening over long term?
Well, I mean, Triton's been around for a lot longer than you and I.
Yeah.
So we only saw it over a few years.
But do you know if it's periodic or not?
Our assumption is that it's not periodic, that it's just been warming over time. And that has to do with the gases that come into its atmosphere.
Huh.
We most of our observations have actually been to Pluto. And in particular, that also helped pinpoint Pluto, because NASA sent a spacecraft by Pluto in 2015. So we were at various times deployed even to South America to make what you might call a picket fence of our apparatus every 5 miles or so along a line to see which of those stations would have Pluto go right in front of it to make this little drop-off in the light curve. And that helped NASA refine the orbit of the New Horizons spacecraft so that it was really right on for the observations of Pluto. And then it turns out that another object was found beyond Pluto, once the spacecraft went by Pluto, we had this, and I say we advisedly, it was NASA, had a 1 meter telescope going out in the spacecraft. So they looked around and found another object further out. And we had another couple of expeditions to South America to pinpoint that object. And the spacecraft was able to observe this object, which was then called, just as a nickname, Ultima Thule, but has been given the official name of Arrokoth. And the spacecraft New Horizons is still going out, and they're looking to see whether it can be used for another object in the future. So there's a, but when it went by, Arrokoth was too small to have an atmosphere, so it just abruptly winked out. But the Pluto has layers in its atmosphere, and that was studied in particular with our what we call occultation techniques. The star is occulted by Pluto in that case, and then when the New Horizons was close up, it could actually photograph layers in the atmosphere.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is astronomer J. M. Pasikoff, Field Memorial Professor of Astronomy and Director of the Hopkins Observatory at Williams College. He is the co-author of the Peterson Field Guide to Weather, which includes, I think my favorite section of it is weather on other planets. Jay, I want to ask you, do all the planets in our solar system have weather? That sounds like a weird question, but does Mercury have weather?
No, I was just going to say, I don't think Mercury has weather. And the moon doesn't have weather. They do detect a few particles from the solar wind hits the moon's surface, for example, and you can detect some ions coming off the moon or off Mercury.
In order for a planet to have weather, it has to have an atmosphere.
Yes. So the weather is in the atmosphere. So Venus has a thick atmosphere.
Okay, well, let's take the planets one at a time moving out from the sun. What I've read about Venus sounds like the weather is awful there. You may think the weather is awful here in New England, but the weather on Venus is absolutely wild. And I remember those very early photographs taken by a Russian probe, I think it was, that landed on Venus. This was decades ago. It was
Venera probes.
Yeah. Talk to me about the weather of Venus. Venus seems extreme.
Well, those Russian probes lasted a few minutes. It couldn't take any longer. And finally, after decades, NASA has a new plan that they're talking about in the next 10 years or so to land on Venus again. But anyway, Venus has a very thick atmosphere. It's about 100 times thicker than the Earth's atmosphere. And we had this very thick greenhouse effect with a lot of carbon dioxide, again, about 100 times more than we have in the Earth's atmosphere. And that is, in fact, what led Carl Sagan and Jim Pollack to realize that we have this greenhouse effect on Earth that we, of course, talk about for our global warming on Earth. We actually have some global warming we know about, a few tens of degrees on Earth that make the average temperature nice for us. But what we don't want is additional global warming on Earth, which we're beginning to see is making things too unstable and too hot for us. But certainly with Venus, we have the atmosphere hot enough to melt lead on the surface of Venus. And that makes it kind of tough to land there. I wouldn't want to live
there. Just a probe is not going to last that long. In a place like that.
They're trying to make the probe last longer. They're talking about gliders in the atmosphere where it's not quite so hot. And it's even been suggested that some life could exist in some layer in the atmosphere. I'm not a big fan of that theory for no particular reason. Seems a little far-fetched. But there is a level in the atmosphere that you can have a reasonable temperature, and you can follow the atmosphere photographically, especially in the ultraviolet as Venus rotates.
Well, let's talk about Mars, because we seem to know the most of the planets. We seem to be getting the most about Mars, and Mars has a thin atmosphere, but it definitely has weather, because I've seen great photographs of dust devils on Mars.
Yes. So where Venus has an atmosphere 100 times thicker than Earth's, Mars is 100 times thinner than Earth's or so. And we can see right through it. But when you land on Mars, there's a dust in the atmosphere. Of course, Mars has this basically oxidized surface, rusty surface. So, but when they first had the Viking probes that landed on Mars for the U.S. Bicentennial in 1976, when they first released the pictures from the Viking spacecraft, they gave it a blue sky. People who were doing the spacecraft, who were doing the imaging back at NASA, just adjusted it. And then pretty soon they realized that they had a color wheel. They could photograph to get the right colors, that the sky is actually pink in the atmosphere. So even before that landing in 1976, when Mariner 9 spacecraft went by, and both the Russians or the Soviets at that time and NASA had a lot of spacecraft that went by. Many of them failed. But in any case, Mariner 9 came and Venus looked pretty uniform. I'm sorry, Mars looked pretty uniform because there was a global dust storm that covered the whole atmosphere.
Jay, don't go by so fast. Of the entire planet?
Yes.
A dust storm covered the entire planet?
That's right.
Yikes.
And then it gradually settled out as the spacecraft was watching. And first they saw a few little blips poking out, and those turned out to be a few tall volcanoes coming out. And eventually it settled down, and we could see the surface. And there's a whole region with these high volcanoes, so-called Tarsus Ridge. One of the tallest is called Mount Olympus. But then there are other cratered areas, flatter areas.
And there's a polar region, too.
Yes. And then there are these polar caps of, in the winter, in the different hemispheres, it's mainly carbon dioxide ice or so-called dry ice. But then that sublimes, leaving a residual cap of water ice. So we know that there's water on Venus and
Mars.
Water on Mars. And the question is what there is at lower latitudes. We see these river channels.
Yep.
We're very pleased that one of our alumni from Williams College, Katie Stack Morgan, is deputy project scientist on this current mission on Mars, and have the Perseverance able to roam around Mars, and they try to land in places where geologically they find interesting looking things that they hope indicate the presence of water in the past. And certainly
they're also using the little flying module. And those pictures have been amazing. I mean, that our successes on Mars far outweigh our failures on Mars, it seems. I think our Martian missions have been incredible.
Yes. Well, it's a lot easier when lead doesn't melt on the surface there.
Well, and then we're going to run out of time. I want to pay attention to the gas giants, too, Jupiter and Saturn. Now, they have weather, but it seems like it's like this. They're almost like stars that never took off. They just have this huge, especially Jupiter, seems like a star that didn't quite ignite or something.
That's accurate. It's a few times not massive enough to have collapsed further, which would have heated up the centers and started nuclear fusion.
But they have these storms like the red eye, which is changing.
Yes,
these storms are just like beyond comprehension about how large they are.
Yes. So the Earth would fit in the Great Red Spot several times over, and we've watched the Great Red Spot change in size over the last few years. and went over the last century, and so we know it's been there for at least 150 years or so, and we don't have imaging from further back than that. Galileo's telescope wasn't good enough to see it, but now with the great detail from the NASA probes that have gone up and the pictures we can take from Hubble, we can see a circulation of gas around the Great Red Spot. And then there are some other smaller spots that aren't colored in the same way. And if you, say, roll a pencil between your two hands and you roll your hands back and forth, you can see the pencil rolls. Well, there are layers in latitude in Jupiter's atmosphere, and these spots roll around between those layers. So we have a lot of studies of the atmosphere of Jupiter. Now, Saturn is further out than Jupiter, of course, and it's enough colder that we think we have the same kind of atmospheric rolling around and spots in the atmosphere, but it doesn't get colored in the same way, so the spots are less obvious.
The moons of both Jupiter and Saturn, for me, are incredibly fascinating. Like Titan, we had a probe that actually landed on Titan. I think it was Huygens. That made a landing, and actually you could see it was like wet sand it was landing on. It was really a fascinating place to look at.
Those are great images.
I love those images.
Yes.
There were methane seas. There were methane seas and there were it looked like you could actually imagine tides in the methane seas or whatever.
Yes. So there are atmospheres on a couple of the moons of Jupiter, and then beyond Jupiter and Saturn, we have Uranus and Neptune that have atmospheres of their own, and the Great Red Spot on Neptune, that was a big surprise.
Yeah,
when the Voyager spacecraft saw it, and it has since disappeared. We already discussed Pluto.
We're completely out of time, believe it or not, and we've just begun to scratch the surface. My guest tonight has been astronomer Jay M. Pasikoff, the Field Memorial Professor of Astronomy and Director of the Hopkins Observatory at Williams College. He's the co-author of the Peterson Field Guide to Weather, which includes a chapter on what we've been talking about, the weather on other planets. Jay, I'm going to have you back, so we're going to talk about some of the other stuff that you've written, and so I hope to talk to you again. So,
I'll enjoy that.
Yeah, thanks very much for being here. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.